So, at the age of 24, living in Ibiza, Matt Haig stepped to a ledge on a cliff with the intention of launching himself to his end. But something pulled him back. That experience, it led him and his girlfriend, who would eventually become his wife, back to his childhood home, where Matt would begin a process of picking up the pieces of his life. A writer, he has kept that season of profound darkness and revelation and recovery within his family. While he deepened into a career as a novelist and a children's book author, it was always there, but never let seen the light of day outside of those who knew him best, not even his friends. But years later, many years later, a simple blog post that he never thought anyone would see effectively outed that experience, leading soon after to a book a year later called Reasons to Stay Alive that became this massive bestseller and also expanded Matt's notoriety into the world of personal growth. He has since blended fiction and nonfiction, penning more novels, sometimes exploring big existential questions, but in honest and accessible ways. And his book, The Midnight Library, just hit 2 million copies sold in the US. And Matt's latest book, The Comfort Book, is kind of like his life raft. It's a collection of notes and lists and stories written over a span of several years that originally served as gentle reminders to his future self that things are not always as dark as they may seem. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that your loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. Good Life Project is brought to you by Air Doctor, makers of those amazing air purifiers I keep in my home studio and have been talking about for a long time now. So even though I talk for a living, my vocal pipes could use some help dealing with indoor air, which can contain so many different irritants. Luckily, my trusty Air Doctor uses an incredibly advanced Ultra HEPA filter to capture particles 100 times smaller than old school HEPA filters. We're talking smoke, pollen, mold, bacteria, all those nasty micro critters in the air. My Air Doctor just gobbles them up so I can podcast and breathe and write and be in peace and with peace of mind. So give your indoor air a purification boost with Air Doctor. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day breathe easy money back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code GOODLIFE and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you'll also receive a free free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. So lock this special offer in by going to airdoctorpro.com or airdoctorpro.com, or just click the link in the show notes and use the promo code GOODLIFE.
I'm looking forward to writing, actually sitting down and writing something new, because most of this year I haven't done
that. What do you look for with that? I'm curious. Is there something that kind of lets you know it's time to sit down, or do you just sort of say, I have a deadline, I need to start putting words on a page?
Yeah, I've had to be quite strict with my UK publishers and PR people, and, you know, I've got auto responses, and I'm sort of saying, you know, okay, we haven't got a book literally out now, so other than my prior commitments, I'm just going to keep my head down and get into it. Because I'm someone who I need a good run-up with ideas. It's not like I can just sort of like switch off, get on my computer, and then just go. I need to really like take a while to get in that zone. And I haven't really had that time. There's always been something. But generally, like, you know, if I'm required to go to London for something, or, you know, it just totally throws me off. So it's been good to actually be strict, because I've always been such a yes person, in the sense that I feel grateful to be asked for things. So I say yes, 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 yes. And these last 2 years have been the first times where I couldn't feasibly be yes to everything person. So it's had to be more no's than yeses. And it's been quite good to just have some sort of sense of boundaries, and that feeling that you don't need to do every opportunity. It's not, you know, there are other, you know, you still have to have a life too. And, you know, there's certain things that you think, well, yeah, that could have been big, but, you know, you have to just sort of create some sort of space thing.
Yeah. I'm curious, you're at a moment in your career at this point where you have this ability to actually, you know, say yes or no to you have more things being presented to you, or more opportunities, than you have time and bandwidth to actually engage with. How do you discern what is worthy of your saying yes at this point?
Well, you know, I think it's two things. I think one of them is, you know, is it something I would actually want to do? You know, you run a little checks and balances about how much time I'd invest in that and how much I'd get out of that. And, you know, for instance, my publicists know that I'm kind of allergic to writing pieces for people, you know, because that really, you know, that takes some mental energy to do it well. And it's never financially worthwhile. And it's also just, you know, that compared to sort of like 10 minutes on the phone to a journalist and you're answering a few questions, that's not that time consuming. But also, I've had to be a bit careful now, even with interviews, about saying yes to things, because we're in this age now that, and I don't get it like a proper, you know, celebrity or something, but people are all about the clicks now, certainly in my country, certainly in the UK, where we have quite a negative press. So if you're doing an interview, I don't really get so much for puff pieces anymore. It's more about me as a person. And that you have to be so careful, because, you know, you'll say one thing out of context, that becomes the headline, and that's the only thing anyone sees from it on social media. So, and I'm someone who's quite loose-lipped. I don't think I've got too many controversial opinions or anything, but I'll just sort of like free flow, which is great on a podcast, obviously, but when it's a newspaper and people aren't getting your intonation, or they're not hearing your voice, it can be a risky, risky thing, that whole media perception. So I've learned the things to say no to. I mean, any piece, a lot of our newspapers have pieces about your income or your house or, you know, what you spend your money on and things like that. And that's just, certainly among British people, that's just asking for a load of negativity to come your way. So it's just about doing things that you think are worthwhile. Sometimes it's because you like the people. Sometimes it's because it's media you yourself consume and you think it'd be cool to be in. Sometimes it's just simply doing a favor for someone. And then there's clear things that doing now. I don't, you know, generally, if a lot of travel's involved, or, you know, it's a speech, I'm not great at speeches. I don't mind interviews. I don't mind being up on stage and being interviewed by someone. But if it's me at the podium in sort of TED Talk mode, I really avoid that. I have done it. I've done a whole tour like that before, but I prefer to have a wing man or wing person who will sort of be there as a support to bounce things off. But yeah, it's just a feeling, isn't it? You know what you know. You as you get older, you tend to know what you like doing. And also, if you really don't like doing something, the chances are it's not going to be very good. You're not going to be able to be your best self. So it's actually, you know, a negative. As with writing books, it's always good to actually write something that you're interested in. It's always good to do things that you're interested in, because then you'll have more to offer and more to say and more enthusiasm for it. And I think that's what I've learned too. You know, when it comes to podcasts, obviously doing yours, I'm very selective. But, you know, it's good if it's a, you know, if you can chat about interesting things. And it's not always the case. And, yeah, sorry, I don't know where I'm going with this ramble. But anyway, yes, I am becoming, I'm becoming slowly more discerning.
Yeah, and I think it's so interesting, you know, like what you shared. We're in this moment right now where if you like to say things that are honest and true, but also may be perceived by some people in some way as provocative or polarizing, if they're not received in context, and we're in this sort of like soundbite society where like you know, people pick and choose what they want to actually focus on, it is a dicey window, you know. But at the same time, I know you're a fan of Twitter, and there are things that you know, there are moments where you kind of have to bring yourself to those. But also at the same time, you know, with you in particular, I'm fascinated by this because in what you just shared. So much of what you've written about and really sort of written publicly about since 2015 or so relates to a life of not sharing what was going on, not sharing your inner life, not sharing your thoughts, your struggles, your anxiety. And it's almost like once you open that floodgate, I wonder, you know, is it almost like a mental health issue to try and figure out where you close it or where you, like when you put it back up?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, for context. I had my real first encounter with mental illness and a breakdown in 1999, continually ill for 3 years. Then since then, had bouts, never quite as deep as that one. But I was not talking about mental health at all or writing about mental health until about 2015. So that was a way over a decade of being quiet to everyone who wasn't my parent or wasn't my partner. Even most of my friends didn't really know. And I lost a few friends here and there, you know, not being able to do things and, you know, and not really explaining why. Yeah. And now, as soon as I started talking about it, as soon as I started writing about it, and then you get this kind of, certainly when you start writing about it, you come out and there's a bit of a shock factor because people didn't know about you. You get this sort of warm flood of support, which for me was very welcome because, you know, I mean, as for a lot of people, one of my key defining memories of illness was loneliness, you know, of feeling like you're literally the only person on the planet who feels like this. And it's melodramatic, but, you know, depression tends to give you these melodramatic thoughts and, you know, feeling very alone, very isolated. So when you talk about it and then the opposite happens and you hear from like thousands of people and they've all had similar experiences and stuff, suddenly you feel like, oh, okay, I was part of something bigger. And it's just something that lots of people go through. It's these sort of invisible wars that lots of people go through. And I found that incredibly comforting because, you know, when I was first ill, you go back 20 years and the mental health conversation was very different. I mean, if you thought about famous people, people in the public eye who are mentally ill or have been through mental illness, you tended to think of famous suicides. It sounds terrible, but, you know, you thought of your Kurt Cobain and your Hemingways and your Virginia Woolf, and you thought, you know, the arc of mental illness was very sort of a tragic narrative always. That's because often you only found out about it when people were literally at their lowest point. So one thing I am thankful for in this day and age is that, and through my own experience of writing about it, is that's a very different situation now, obviously. When we think of mental illness, we don't automatically think it's a continual downward spiral and some sort of people who are too creative or too sensitive for this world. And, you know, they just kind of, and that sort of narrative, that quite romanticized narrative has changed. And we see it much more as a health issue among other health issues. And you can think always now of living surviving, thriving public figures who have had known, you know, sports people, singers, writers, whoever, who have gone through stuff, who still know good things in my life. So that's great. And it was very addictive, really, for me to sort of like come out and do that. I mean, I think in terms of my books, I'm at a point now where enough is enough. I don't feel I'm qualified to say more than I already have said, because I've written now three, okay, relatively short, but three non-fiction books about mental illness. There's obviously my fiction book, The Midnight Library, which has a strong theme of mental illness and suicide. And I feel like I've explored in each of the non-fiction books, I found a different angle to sort of come at it. In the novel, obviously, that's a totally different angle to come at it. But I've kind of done it now. I will still talk online a bit about it because it's often just in my head and it's, you know, it's not an issue that goes away. But in terms of like going deeper in terms of book format, I feel like this is the time to step away from it. And I also want to sort of prove to myself and others, hopefully, that I have more in me than just directly talking about depression or drawing on that part of my personal experience. And I just get a little bit bored as well after a while. I love having a platform where at any point I can say something. But also Twitter, it's very dangerous, you know, because certainly for someone like me, because when I'm talking, I often use very sort of simple words. As a writer, I'm just drawn to sort of monosyllables and making things as stripped down and kind of universal as possible. But it's a universality drawn from my own subjective experience. So, but when you're actually sort of making a statement about mental health, I'm not meaning it applies to everyone, but I'm trying to sort of make it readable and accessible to everyone. And then it goes out there. And then someone obviously, because everyone does, have a different experience of their mental illness. And then they think, oh, well, are you trying to tell me how I should feel about my, and it's like, I'm not, but I can see how on Twitter these misinterpretations and tensions happen. So I'm being a bit more careful of how I talk about it on Twitter, at least. I feel like Instagram, there's a bit more elasticity. People are willing to cut you some more slack and be more supportive and understand context. Whereas in Twitter, I almost think we opposite tendency is true. You're over-policed and it almost stifles sort of your free expression of what you want to say or think. And, you know, obviously in a mental health context, I'm very pro people being able to talk about their own experience. I just think when you start to have a reasonably big platform on there, then you have to be aware that not everyone is going to like what you say. And some people are really not going to like what they say. Even if it's only 5% of the people who are negative, then it's still, it can still get in. And it certainly, if you're feeling depressed yourself, the negative stuff is actually more likely to get in because it's sort of, so it, I think there's another dimension with mental health where you have to sort of be aware of your own self-care. And I haven't always been in the past. I feel I'm getting a little bit better. I think I got into a little bit of a scrape in January where I was sort of getting back to people I shouldn't have been getting back to. And the moment you do that, you're just drawing attention to negativity and like putting a microscope on it. So I'm getting better. If I really want to say something, and I think it might not go down with everyone, I either don't say it or I say it with confidence and then walk away from it. It's just about using social media in the right way. For me, for years, because I was quite an early person on Twitter, I used it almost as a, like a lot of people did back then. I used it almost like a, it was just an impulse. There was no impulse control. It was just like, it was whatever I was thinking was there. And that was the sort of joy of it. And you can do that when you've got a few hundred followers. But when you've got thousands of followers, it becomes a little bit more tricky and you have to be a bit more accountable for what you're saying. So yes, I think Twitter has changed. Certainly my experience of Twitter has changed. I'm having to be a little bit, I mean, I'll never be full professional, but I'm having to be a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting because on the one hand, you've got this platform that allows you to connect with other people and realize you're not alone, which I think is one of the most powerful parts of it. And at the same time, it can become this mechanism for just becoming, you know, like a full-scale assault. And each platform has its different culture. It's funny. I was also one of the very early people on the platform, I think back in late 2007, 2008, when on any given day, you actually wouldn't know whether the platform was going to be up or not. You know, it was South by Southwest would happen and Twitter was down because, you know, a couple thousand people were on it. And it's like, that was it. But it is interesting how the conversation has changed in a really powerful way.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Air Doctor, makers of those amazing air purifiers I keep in my home studio and have been talking about for a long time now. So even though I talk for a living, my vocal pipes could use some help dealing with indoor air, which can contain so many different irritants. Luckily, my trusty Air Doctor uses an incredibly advanced Ultra HEPA filter to capture particles 100 times smaller than old school HEPA filters. We're talking smoke, pollen, mold, bacteria, all those nasty micro critters in the air. My Air Doctor just gobbles them up so I can podcast and breathe and write and be in peace and with peace of mind. So give your indoor air a purification boost with Air Doctor. Air Doctor comes with a 30-day breathe easy money back guarantee. So if you don't love it, just send it back for a refund minus shipping. Head to airdoctorpro.com and use the promo code GOODLIFE and you'll receive up to $300 off air purifiers. Exclusive to podcast customers, you'll also receive a free 3-year warranty on any unit, which is an additional $84 value. So lock this special offer in by going to airdoctorpro.com or airdoctorpro.com, or just click the link in the show notes and use the promo code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight-up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Good Life Project is sponsored by Wonderful Pistachios. So listen up, all you busy bosses running around town, fueling your days with sad desk snacks. This is a PSA that it's time to give your afternoon pick-me-up a super yummy and very crunch-tastic makeover with Wonderful Pistachios. I'm talking 6 grams of complete plant-based protein packed into every satisfyingly crackable, crunchable ounce. That's all 9 essential amino acids. So whether you're an old school roasted and salted fan, which is kind of me actually, or you like to walk your taste buds over to the wild side with jalapeno lime, Wonderful Pistachios have a flavor for every craving. And if you don't want to crack shells, which I happen to love doing for some odd reason, Wonderful Pistachios no shells let you skip the mess and get right to the fun. So do yourself a favor, pistachio people. Make your snacks more nutritious and delicious with the protein punch of Wonderful Pistachios. Your 3 p.m. hunger pangs and taste buds will thank you. And quit settling for those sad desk snacks. You deserve better. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com and get cracking. You've referenced a couple of times this moment back about 20 years ago. And I know that you end up in Ibiza, basically working in the club scene as bartender slash promoter slash whatever it is that everyone does down there. But, you know, it's interesting to me because you described this 3-year window that led you to a place where you came very close to taking your own life. And that became a catalyzing moment to step back and really and step back into a process of figuring things out. But I'm actually curious what landed you there in the first place, because you undergrad, you study English literature, and then you end up in Leeds doing a master's in English lit. And then the next move out of that is Ibiza. And I was curious how does that decision get made?
Well, I first went to Ibiza in 1996. Me and my girlfriend went on holiday to Barcelona. We'd spent a lot of time in Barcelona. And then in the middle of the week, we were young and we wanted to party. And then we met these Spanish guys in a bar who said, oh, you want to get the ferry to Ibiza? So we got the ferry to Ibiza. We had the best sleepless three nights of our lives. Went back home and then said, oh, next year we'll work at in Ibiza. And then so we did that for 3 years. And so I'd have my winters and you know, 9 months of the year. In Britain, we have a nine-month winter. So it's basically most of the time was in this cold northern climate, you know, in the north of England. So even colder and wetter than London, in like Leeds and Hull, which you may not have heard of in the north of England. And, you know, studying. And then we had this sort of opposite existence in bright sunshine, you know, loud music, fun. And I think penduluming between that, especially that year I did my master's degree, because you had an option where you could do the degree in 1 year or spread over 2 years and do a bit more part-time. I did it over 1 year. And for the first few months, hadn't really buckled down. So I had this really intense period, about 4 months. I was trying to do this whole potentially 2 year degree course and, you know, reading about Byron and the Romantics and, you know, critical theory and all these French postmodern philosophers like Baudrillard and Derrida. And it was sending me a little bit insane. And I wanted almost brainlessness. I just wanted to sort of like go out and just sort of lose myself in the opposite. So I'd have those two unhealthy extremes of sort of like overthinking and then unthinking. And the year of my breakdown actually was the summer after that, because what happened after my master's degree is we moved to London and I was working in dead-end jobs. I'd have a job for about 3 weeks and then either I'd get fired because I was useless at the job, or I would dramatically, as if I'm in a movie version of my own life, I'd walk out one lunchtime and, you know, never be seen again. That happened twice, actually. So I was obviously having some kind of mental troubles that I wasn't recognizing and masking by going to the pub every night and drinking beer. And I feel like Ibiza was just like an extension of that, an extension of the escape into the pub. It was just like 4 months of drink, drugs, very little sleep, loud noise, unhealthy food, and just a mess, really. But it was there were such moments of escape and freedom within that, like you live for those little moments. And I feel like I had to reach the point I reached in Ibiza. I'm almost scared. It sounds strange. I'd almost be scared to know the version of me who didn't have that breakdown. Because if I hadn't got that extremely ill, and I have to say, as I always say, but I get bored of saying it, but I think it's important, because when people think, oh, you went wild in Ibiza, then obviously the breakdown was because you took loads of drugs and then you fell apart and had a bad trip or something. Actually, by the end of our third summer in Ibiza, and we had actual day jobs there, I was relatively bored of that stuff. And on the day I actually broke down, and it was a day, a specific day, it wasn't like a gradual thing. I broke down suddenly and had a panic attack that sort of didn't end about 22 years ago today, actually. And, you know, I hadn't drank a drop of alcohol. I hadn't smoked a cigarette. It was 11 in the morning. So I hadn't done drugs for months, actually, at that point. And I feel like what happened to me was partly because in two weeks after that, I was due to go back home, go back to London, get a real job. Me and Andrea had sort of decided this was going to be our last summer in Ibiza. We've got to sort of grow up. I was 24 years old, didn't want to grow up. So I feel like the breakdown for me was like that brick wall I was sort of hitting, where even the link between doing a master's degree and going to the nightclubs of Ibiza, for me, was both of them were ways not to actually grow up and face the real world. You know, I'd stay at university forever. I'd stay going to nightclubs forever. I would, you know, stay going to the pub forever. I just anything that would put off becoming a responsible adult. And so, you know, smashing into that mental breakdown of panic disorder, depression, generalized anxiety disorder, bits of OCD that were never properly diagnosed. But, you know, my main diagnosis was panic disorder because I was just in a state of sort of terror. That for me was how I grew up in a strange way. And I overuse sort of metaphors and cliches about depression. But I think one of the reasons people turn to metaphors with depression is because you go through this invisible thing that's hard to get people to understand. And I do kind of see, like, I love talking about caterpillars and butterflies because of the cocoon phase when the caterpillar is in its dissolving in its own enzymes for 2 weeks in the cocoon, and then it's transformed into something else. The caterpillar is, in a very physical sense, breaking down and sort of dissolving in its own sort of acids. And, you know, I do genuinely think of my breakdown as a kind of cocoon in a sense. You know, I literally, because I became agoraphobic with the panic, I was literally cocooned back in my childhood bedroom back in England. And I very rarely went out on my own. I was in these sort of dark rooms under grey skies that winter. And going through absolute hell, but I look back on it now as a kind of transformative, necessary step. Obviously, if I could have gone back to be a teenager, to be a young adult, to be a 20-something person and actually say, hey, you've got issues here, you just need to grow up, you know, as myself now, you know, you've got to get physically healthy, you've got to start addressing some mental things, then, you know, it could have been different. But to reach that point of awareness for me, I think would have been quite difficult without having to reach a point of rock bottom. So even though I'd never want to go through a full-blown maddening breakdown like that, I wouldn't actually want to switch to the timeline where that hadn't happened, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the result of it, you stepping into a place of saying, okay, I need to figure this out and unwind it and figure out, how do I move forward? How do I step back into a life that's more healthy and constructive? And I've had this conversation with so many people who have had moments in their lives where they have been profoundly brought to their knees. And that led to some, you know, really, really big change in the way that they stepped back into their lives, or the way they slowly got back up from their knees. And I've asked this, you know, so many of them, if not every one of them, like, do you feel like you can get back up and be in the place that you are now, like later in life, without going to that place? And to the one, almost everyone has said, like, I don't invite it. I didn't want it. It was horrendous. And I don't see how I would be here now, the way I am now, without having been brought to that place, which is never an invitation for people to say, oh, let me, like, you know, like, push hard and, like, see if I can get there. You know, that is absolutely not what we're saying. But I've always been curious, you know, can you reach that point? Is there a way to get through to a place of recovery and stepping into a healthier place without going through that sort of dark night of the soul?
I think there is, but it takes you have to be kind of in tune with yourself. And the problem with me is I wasn't at all in tune with myself. I was trying to continually escape myself, you know, and always escape, you know, with travel, going to different countries. But you always take yourself with you, don't you? So it's that old cliche. And I'd reached a point where I couldn't escape from myself any longer. And then I broke down. I can remember a real turnaround point for me. It was a few months after my actual breakdown back in England. And I was having another dip, and I was in a supermarket, and I was a mess. I was hiding tears. I was a mess. I was sort of imagining. I had these kind of hallucinations, which weren't what people think of as hallucinations. I wasn't literally like on an acid trip where I'd see giant chocolate bars walking around. I'd be tortured by a lot of mental imagery every time I sort of closed my eyes. And the more, as with all sorts of anxieties and fears, the more you are scared of it, the more it comes to you. So I was at that point, and I was terrifying myself and then terrifying myself some more, and you get into a cycle. But then I was at this point in a supermarket, and with no natural lighting. It was sort of an underground supermarket, and I was so sensitive to everything. I could really feel that, you know, if there was no natural light. I was at a point, and I thought, you know, I'm as low as you can feel, but I realized at a point, I'm still going to live. I realized that if I wasn't going to live, if I was going to, you know, do something reckless and stupid, I would have done it. And I hadn't done it. And I, from that point on, I thought it gave me a little bit of power over the depression and over the fear. Because I thought, well, literally, over the last few months, my mind had thrown everything at me. And I was still there. And it was almost like, and I'm not a particularly religious person, you know, typical British, kind of somewhere between atheism and agnostic. But I was at a point where I thought, you know, if I had been a religious person, I would have felt, I'd sort of touched my soul here. It's kind of like, there's a part of me that couldn't be broken down person, that couldn't be, you know, got at. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that had crumbled away. And it is called breakdown for a reason. You do feel like yourself breaking down. But there'd been a part of me, and I suppose it's a part of you, you know, when I've been reading about Buddhism and stuff, it's very much about watching yourself. You know, there's always the two versions of yourself. There's the self that's feeling, and then there's the self that's experiencing the feeling and being aware of your experience. So there's always a separation. Even in the midst of total pain, there's a person experiencing the feeling, and then there's another person observing you experiencing the feeling. And so I'd reached that point where I realized, okay, well, that person who's observing all this, then they're going to survive. There's a sort of, you know, I think we say rock bottom for a reason, because you reach rock bottom and you find something solid, granite and hard. And that, I thought, okay, it's not going to be easy. There's going to be loads of dips. But I really always held on to that moment where I thought, okay, I can't be broken down further. And that was always, you know, people always say to depressed people, oh, remember good times before. And that has a value. You know, it is important to remember that you haven't always felt this way and you'll feel better again. But there's also kind of a value. You can reframe things where actually, if you've been through some bad times, that can have a value, because that's how you measure your progress. Because you can actually think, well, that day in Ibiza, you know, I've had a horrendous day today. I've had 3 panic attacks, but it wasn't as bad as that day. So you can actually have a bad day then that feels like progress. And even if you're having the worst day imaginable, then you can sort of like put it into a bank of bad days and think, well, okay, this day actually is going to have some use in the future, because it's going to be a marker. And I'm not going to. So I kind of became my own therapist and sort of taught myself how to sort of measure progress and all of that. And because the nature of my depression was coupled with panic disorder, it gave me a lot of invisible deadlines. Like, it would say the most ridiculous stuff, you know, you won't be alive by the age of 25, or if you're alive, you'll be in a straitjacket somewhere, or, you know, your partner will leave you, you'll never get a job, this. Gives you a big list. And obviously some bad things do happen in your life. No one's life is a bed of roses. I've had lots of bad things happen to me. But that worldview that depression gives you of ultra catastrophe all the time, that doesn't happen. So what happens is time slowly disproved the voice of depression. You know, I'd get to my 25th birthday, then my 26th birthday, then 30th, 40th birthday, and you're still there. So time is kind of the one thing that's bigger than depression. And another sort of happy side effect of that is it, as being a young person, I can remember always worrying about aging. I can remember, you know, being a hypochondriac, worrying about physical illnesses, whatever. It totally reframed my view of time. I'm always sort of like so grateful to have reached an age. I'm sort of proud of being older. You know, I'm actually like that distance between my 24-year-old self. You know, I'm so glad I'm not one of those people who spends their life nostalgically saying, oh, when I was in my early 20s, that was the best years of my life, because it really wasn't. And I have got progressively happier as I've got older. And so basically it's good to have that sort of measure of progress and actually, you know, embrace getting older. It's a kind of little triumph for me.
Yeah, I love the notion of time being this sort of slow, deliberate provider of evidence that controverts the storyline in your head. And eventually you start checking all the boxes that you thought would never be checked. And you're like, oh, so then all those things I was telling, they actually can't be true, because time is showing me like that they were all wrong. but you got to be around for that time, you know?
Exactly.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
So you have this moment, you have this season, late 90s, very early 2000s. And at the same time, you start writing novels, kids' books, building a reputation, starting to build a career. And 2014, I guess, is when you first... But all the mental health stuff for you is happening in the background. This is not a public part of your conversation. You're not writing about it. You're building your chops, you know, more in the world of fiction.
Yeah.
And this is just what's going on in your personal life. And then 2014, you write a blog post basically talking about that moment in Ibiza where you step to the edge of a cliff and then step back.
Yeah.
Which creates, you know, like a tremendous response. The next year, that turns into the book, Reasons to Stay Alive, which is received incredibly. You know, it becomes a huge hit. It reveals a lot of what we've been talking about right now. But what I'm curious about is you have up until that point then built a career, like a dozen or so years, more than that, as a writer and as a novelist. And in the world of writing, so often people kind of say, you know, you have your lane. You have the thing that you're known for. You know, keep doing more of what you're going to be successful at, what you've proven to be successful at. Especially your publisher is saying that to you.
Yeah.
When you decide to come out with a new book, when in 2015, you're like, Reasons to Stay Alive is coming out. And this is a complete and utter departure of what you've ever written about and also ever talked about, because this is about you. Mm. I'm curious about that decision and that moment and how it felt to you, like the day before all of this comes out, or even stepping up the year before, the day before you hit publish on that initial blog post that reveals this.
Yeah, no, it's well, the blog post was written with, you know, the blog post was going to be an end in itself. That was going to be my first and last word on it. The blog post, I'd been writing these blog posts every week for a charity called Book Trust. I was a writer in residence for 6 months. And for a lot of that time, I'd just been writing the generic stuff, the writing tips, different things about being a writer. And I was feeling a bit dry. I hadn't actually got much to say. And so out of sheer necessity of a deadline looming, and it must have coincided with me feeling a bit more relaxed about my experience. I just thought, wow, this is a good kind of safe space to test the water, because not many people have been reading this blog, and I can just sort of like put it out there and see what sort of the response is. And I put it out there, and it was the only blog that I'd written for that charity, which, you know, had any kind of traction. And the response was amazing, loads and loads of comments. But I still don't think I would have turned that into a book without a meeting. I'd met a woman called Kathy Rentenbrink, who's she's a writer herself, and she's experienced depression and a lot of trauma in her own life. And she knew a lot about publishing in London. She'd worked for the sort of main trade magazine called The Bookseller. She'd been high up there, and she'd met me a couple of times and we'd got on. And anyway, I had a meeting with her, and she said, Matt, you need to write a book about depression. It would go down so well. I've got a good publisher in mind. It would work. You know, I think the time's ready. And I was a bit hesitant, because I thought, well, you know, I've done reasonably well with my last book, which was a fiction book. But I should really capitalize on that by writing another fiction book. But she was quite persuasive. And then I got into the idea. And then I put it to my publishers, and they weren't that into it. My UK publisher, they hate me saying this, but they really weren't that into it when I first went to them about it. My publisher himself, he said, you know, the head publisher, he said, Matt, you've got good imagination, just turn it into fiction, you know, and make it universal, make it fiction. And I was a bit stubborn with him because I actually remembered when I was depressed. And what really helped me was when finally you heard of people who'd gone through something. I can remember going even to a homeopath. I didn't particularly believe in homeopathy. My mum wanted me to go to a homeopath. And I was reluctant to go. And I was so glad I did, not because of the tinctures I was given, the homeopathy stuff, but the woman herself had been through this ordeal and had depression and panic disorder. And she was telling me there in front of me what she'd been through. And there she was, smiling, happy, and, you know, with a job and able to cope. And that was so inspiring to see people who'd been through absolute hell, been suicidal, come out the other side. So I thought, if I wrote this as a novel, you're going to lose all that. You're not going to have the sort of authentic thing of someone saying, this is me, I've been through this, you know, here you are. So with Reasons to Stay Alive specifically, I didn't know quite what I was writing, but I knew it had to have that sense of authenticity. It had to be nonfiction. And that was my only guiding impulse. And I talked the publishers into it. They paid me very little money for it. I would have got four times as much, put it that way, if it had been a novel, if I'd have fictionalized it. But sometimes in your career, you have to take what looks like the smaller move, or you have to have a bit of faith in yourself. And I went away, I wrote it. I ignored terms like self-help book, memoir, things like that. I just thought, I'm going to ignore the fact it's even a book. I'm just going to try and put some words on the page that would communicate to someone like me on a metaphorical and literal cliff edge in Ibiza, 24 years old. How would you get into that person's brain? What would you say to that person? What would you say to that young person going through that? And that was what I was doing with that book. And I definitely look back at it now, and there's parts of it I cringe at, parts of it I get the terminology wrong. I talk about being a depressive a lot, and I don't really like doing that because although I'd talk now about someone, you know, having depression or me having depression, I feel like when you label yourself as a depressive, that's comes a whole lot of weight. But I'm still very proud I wrote that book because it has apparently been useful. You know, people say it's been useful to them, and it's been useful for people who haven't had depression, understanding their son, their partner, their parent, whoever it is, what they've been going through. So I was very glad, certainly in this country, to add to the mental health conversation at that time. It was certainly the most personal thing I'd written, because even though I've written two more nonfiction books, one's called The Comfort Book, which is just it's not necessarily aimed at someone with mental illness. It's just about ideas and things that have always comforted me. And then there's another one, a bit more negative, called Notes on a Nervous Planet, which is about all the ways the modern world is slowly making us insane. So that was more of a social look. But Reasons to Stay Alive was the one that actually sort of came from my own sort of flashbacks and experiences and stuff like that. And writing it actually was such a joy and such a release, even though it was about this heavy stuff, because, you know, people ask, you know, what's it like going back to the worst experiences of your life? But the thing is, with worst experiences of your life or worst experiences of anyone's life, they're always kind of there. You know, they're always defining us in some way. So often when you actually let them out and you talk about them and you write about them, it actually feels more of a release than a sort of going back to. So it kind of wrote itself as much as a book ever writes itself. It was, you know, it was a short, yeah, I think it's something like 35,000 words. You know, it was probably the shortest thing I've ever written, but it was the most meaningful at that moment.
It's always interesting to me when somebody decides to step out and not only share something about themselves, but also takes a risk in sort of like offering something to the world, which is so close to the bone and also so profoundly different than what they've offered before. But I'm wondering actually if that's really true, because if you look at your writing, even your fiction, your kids' books, there's an interesting thing that often happens. It reminded me in a little bit of, so Kate DiCamillo, who's been on the podcast in the past, writes these fantastic children's books. And I remember she told me, she said, always tell the truth, but give them hope.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you thread into your writing, even in the fiction, even in the kids' books. It's like, you're not pulling punches. You're not saying, and everything's going to be awesome, and here's the story. You're kind of saying some hard stuff is going to happen.
Yeah.
And you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, which is the fictionalized version of this. So you know, when I first was thinking about it, I was like, oh, this is a huge departure. But I'm like, is it really? Like, the departure is really just saying, look, this is a true story and this is my own experience. And, you know, even the stuff that you've written since then, you know, the kid stuff, the Truth Pixie, you know, it's all weaving into the same texture, you know, in the way that you, it feels like you're bringing yourself to your writing, but you're doing it in ways which that are sort of context appropriate for different types of readers.
I think that's true, because I always worry. I always think, oh, what genre should I write now? And, you know, it's nice to have freedom, but there's also the sort of anxiety of having freedom where you don't know which path to take. And I always sort of sometimes envy like a thriller writer who has like one central detective and they write 37 books with that detective. And it'd be so nice to sort of sit down on the sofa and to know precisely the book they're going to write. But I think with me, what I try and write, it requires lots of different angles. But yeah, you're right, within it, I'm always trying to offer something. So even though when I'm writing something totally fantastical, like that children's book you mentioned, which I wrote, incidentally, straight after Reasons to Stay Alive, I sort of wanted to go into an opposite world. So I went into North Pole, Santa Claus, Father Christmas. It's a book called A Boy Called Christmas. It's going to be a film now. And that, even though it's got pixies and elves and reindeer and trolls and all kinds of things, it's really a story about grief. There's a death that, spoil it for anyone who wants to read it, but there's a death that comes halfway through the book. And it's about trying to find some kind of hope within that darkness. So I never want to write, you know, pure rainbows and unicorns out of context. I want to actually go to some kind of, I normally start with some kind of authentic, hopefully authentic pain or struggle, and then try and find the light within that. Because I think that's how you offer hope to people. Because if you just sort of like say you need to do this, or you need to just sort of smile and be happy, then no one's going to take that. You need to actually show that you've some experience of it yourself, or your fictional characters have some experiences of it, and it feels true. And I think one thing that stories can do is they can actually give us that kind of nourishment and strength by, you know, you're going through a hard time in life and you're reading about someone who's going through an even worse time in their life. I used to be obsessed as a teenager, and I was going through a hard time as a teenager. You know the film Papillon with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman? I used to be obsessed with that film. People warn teenagers not to watch that film because it's so sort of, and there's been a remake recently, because it's so sort of like intense and got so many scenes of torture and prison and stuff. But that was a comforting film for me to watch because it showed what human beings can survive. You know, I suppose, you know, Shawshank Redemption's another obvious one, but those sort of prison films, they show what life is like. And if you cannot, because ultimately Papillon is a kind of story of hope, and it's seen as a bleak prison drama. But yeah, you have to offer something which has some resonance, some truth to it, but you can take some sort of like positivity from it. And it's not always in an obvious way, as it isn't in Papillon. You know, it's not always obvious, the hope, but sometimes things that help you aren't always the most obvious things or helpful things. But yeah, I mean, with The Midnight Library, my story, The Midnight Library, I was very keen at the start to make sure the reader knew that Nora is in this horrendous state of mind. And, you know, she's really, really feeling low. And I knew that that was going to put some, would inevitably put some readers off, because you've got quite a hard sort of 30 pages of suicidal despair to get through at the start. But I think, you know, and very much me trying to sort of borrow some of the techniques of things like It's a Wonderful Life and stuff, I think if you start in that low place, you can end up in a much more hopeful place than if you'd have never gone there. You know what I mean? And I feel like that in life too. That's why I'm sort of thankful for having known so many periods of rock bottom, because you end up more grateful for the neutral moments. You know, as a young, quite selfish young man, I always felt that to be happy, you needed extreme experiences. You needed to get out of your head, or you needed to watch the most violent Tarantino movie, or you needed the loudest music up to 11, or this, that, and the other, you know, all quite typical young man cliches. And afterwards, after sort of falling apart, I just appreciated neutrality a bit more. I appreciated not always doing, you know, and actually just sort of, you know, what I was most scared of was just sort of sitting on a sofa with my own thoughts or just sort of lying in bed with my own thoughts. I wanted to sort of like stay out all night, I think, partly because I just, when I hit the bed, I just wanted to collapse and just not have a moment of thinking of it. So to try and have a life of not thinking. And you can't do that. You eventually have to come to terms with yourself and you have to sort of, you know, not necessarily go around in a state of thinking you're amazing all the time, but you have to come to some sort of, some kind of place of kindness towards yourself and tolerance of yourself. And that's kind of what my recovery was for me. It was actually accepting myself when I was feeling low, accepting my, you know, not beating myself up for having a couple of labels here and there that have been diagnosed to me, and just sort of like total acceptance. And once you reach that point, it helps you even when you're better. It helps you appreciate things and understand things. One very interesting thing I think about anxiety, which again is kind of hellish to go through, is you're very much in tune with what makes you feel better and what makes you feel worse. Like often when we're just sort of running normally, we're not always aware of, you know, how little things affect our states of mind. But when you've got mental illness, those little things become massive things. You know, like the sun goes behind a cloud and you sort of like feel a weight and you feel some sense of relief about something and it's like hallelujah chorus going off in your head. So you actually learn about yourself, what you kind of need to be happy. And you build up while you're still ill, you build up a little toolbox. You sort of know, and it changes. I'm sure the toolbox changes from person to person. There are some overlaps. For me, very much, you know, going out into the open air, running every morning, doing things like that, getting interested in stuff, getting interested in anything that wasn't my own brain was so important to me.
That last thought you just had, as you were sharing that, something that a guy named Chip Connelly once told me, actually, I think it was in a book that he wrote. He said, you know, people think the opposite of depression is happiness, but he's like, the opposite of depression isn't happiness, it's curiosity. Yeah. Because that ceases to exist when you're in, and he said, you know, like he knew that he was starting to turn the corner when he started to be curious about things again, including himself and his own life.
Yeah. Find a passion as large as your fear, you know, find something that will fill that space. And I definitely, you know, I don't want to romanticize mental illness in any way because it's no fun at all. But I do think there's something about when you've experienced any kind of grief or pain in your life where it takes over a kind of space of you, but it sometimes expands that space. So when that pain leaves or retreats slightly, you're left with the space. So you can fill that space with other stuff and you actually feel in some sense kind of like a bigger person because of it. Like you actually, that sense of gratitude, that sense of love, that sense of appreciation of whatever it is, of cooking, of, you know, going out to a concert or whatever it is, you have a greater sort of sensitivity to that stuff. And yeah, it's not always worth the price, obviously, but if you can take that silver lining, then it is quite a therapeutic thing.
One of the things you shared, you talked about the Comfort book, which is the most recent, and which is an interesting book also because it's, you know, this is just sort of a book of thoughts. It's almost like, you know, you can flip to any page, any given page, and just like, oh, here's anything from a sentence or two to, you know, like a little bit longer. And it's just, it's almost like, you know, a daily meditation type of thing. Look, here's an interesting little thing that's going to plant a seed and let me just noodle on it, you know, like as I move through the day. One of the things you share, is that happiness occurs when you forget who you're expected to be. That landed in a really direct and powerful way with me.
Yeah, I think so. When I think back to the times I'm happiest, it's always when you're at your least self-conscious, when you're kind of like, you're not even trying necessarily actively to be happy. There's no sort of try in it. There's no kind of effort in it. It's moments where you just kind of lose yourself, whether you were laughing with family or friends, or, you know, you're just sort of like feeling happy. It can happen just walking the dog. It can happen just those little moments that feel like the universe is suddenly in harmony and you're part of this great cosmic order. And everything just feels right. And it just kind of happens. But it often happens when you're not trying to be a certain way. You're not worrying about your next deadline. You're not thinking of yourself as, in my case, like Mr. Writer or Mr. Mental Health Spokesperson, whatever else, you know, whatever labels people attach to you. You're just sort of free of all that. You're not drowning in those expectations. And often they're very much self-expectations. And yeah, just being, you know, a human animal in a sort of positive sense.
Hmm. Feels like a good place for us to come full circle in our conversation as well. So hanging out in this international container of the Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
I think gratitude is the first thing that comes up. Just appreciating, you know, there's so many things we have in every life to complain about and to be down about, but that we can actually forget the things we have to be grateful for. And I noticed early on with myself that a lot of the things I had dreamed of, that I'd imagined happiness would come if I only got, you know, whatever it is, study relationship, a book deal, something like that. When you get that, it's so fleeting. You have about 3 weeks and then it's on to the next thing. The goalposts shift and it's got to be like a best-selling book. It's got to be, you know, like, we've got to be married or got to have kids. There's always a next little goalpost. And I think, you know, if we can kind of resist that urge and actually want, you know, some of those things that we always did want, but now we have them, you know, keep that sense of wanting and gratitude towards them. If we can want what we already have along the way, rather than continually looking forward, I think a good life is just sort of a gratitude for where we are, what we've got, and not that yearning that we're often encouraged to feel, and to just sort of like, yeah, accept ourselves and accept the miracle, the messy miracle often, of being alive on this fragile, beautiful planet of ours.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Hey, before you leave, if you love this episode, safe bet you'll also love the conversation that we had with Kate DiCamillo about writing and creativity and telling the truth, but always leaving people with hope. You'll find a link to Kate's episode in the show notes. And even if you don't listen now, be sure to click and download so it's ready to play when you're on the go. And of course, if you haven't already done so, go ahead and follow Good Life Project in your favorite listening app. And if you appreciate the work we're doing here on Good Life Project, please go check out my new book, Sparked. It'll reveal some incredibly eye-opening things to you about what makes you come alive, about the fundamental nature of work that lights a fire inside of you. And it'll show you how to tap these insights to reimagine and reinvent work as a source of meaning and purpose and joy. You'll find a link in the show notes, or you can also find it at your favorite bookseller now. Till next time, I'm Jonathan Fields.